we'll just start the meeting and move along till we get a quorum. And so I ended the last meeting by telling the IFO that and the Minnesota State College faculty, if they wanted to talk, or MSUSA or the Minnesota State Student Association. And I see that Rod is here, so I'll have you come up. Come on up. Introduce yourself. Looks like you're the only one that wants to talk about the Minsku budget currently. So I just identify yourself for the tape, and then we'll move on.
Okay. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Rod Henry, president of the Interfaculty Organization. We represent about 3,800 faculty on the Minsku University campuses. The word for today is decimation. In the old days, what the Romans would do is they would take a unit, line them up, and every 10th member would be eliminated. That's decimation. It's happening at Moorhead. It's happening at Mankato. We have over 80 positions going in Mankato as I speak. The problem is, in the old days, when they decimated a Roman unit, they decimated them because they were doing poorly. We're not. We're doing a great job, and instead of that, we're being decimated. Now, we know the state has budget difficulties. We know that cuts are going to be made. We appreciate the federal stimulus money, because without it, it wouldn't be decimation. It'd be a total catastrophe. We do agree with the way the governor allocated the cuts, his recent cuts between the University of Minnesota and Minsky. He cut both systems back to their 2006 level. That's a $10.5 million cut to Minsky, $36.5 million cut to the University of Minnesota. You know the enrollment increases. You know the attempts described last time to increase productivity that had been dictated by our central office. Let me say, some of the techniques: increase class size, increase use of adjuncts, increase use of online learnings, reductions in time to allow faculty to stay current in their fields, conduct scholarship. These are short-term solutions. They have long-term negative consequences for the students and communities we serve. Let me give you one example from my marketing management class. I normally have 20 students, and each student has to take one company from the Star Tribune 100. They're listed the top 100 companies in Minnesota. Well, that was 2 years ago. Now the class is 30 students, and that means it's not individual, it's group projects. So students who may very well need individual attention at the senior level to make sure that they're leaving the school with the quality we want them to have, they're just not going to get it. Last year, our union took 0 and 0 in our contract settlement. We were the first union in the state to settle. We were the first professors' union in the nation to settle. Well, let me tell you, we took a lot of grief for doing so. What happened as a result of that? When unallotments occurred, the central office took about half the amount that we feel they should take. The universities took a disproportionate share of it. So let me sum it all up. As of today, we have 82 faculty positions on the line in Mankato. We have 50 that are apparently gone in Moorhead. We have things happening on the other campuses that tell me that they won't be far behind. If that's the situation that we face, we think that most, if not all, the cuts should be coming out of our central office. That's going to protect teaching and learning on the campuses. If people want to know where to start, the Office of the Legislative Auditor has some pretty good suggestions. At that point, I'll open it up to questions if there are any.
Any questions at all from members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for your testimony, and I do want to compliment you, because I know that the IFO was the first teacher organization in the country last year to take a 0 and 0 because of the financial situation we're in. Mr. Nelson, did you want to come down and say something for the two-year community and technical college teachers?
Thank you, Chair Rukavina, and members. Rick Nelson from the Minnesota State College faculty. We know, as a committee, you're faced with a significant challenge, and do agree as the IFO in supporting the cuts that are on the table recommended by the governor under the current economic status in Minnesota. But we also know, looking to the future, that the physical challenge for our colleges that have been growing by leaps and bounds are going to be there in FY 12 and 13. And at this time, those challenges are difficult to see by our faculty members because our classes are full. They're fuller than they've ever been. As a result, our ability to provide the individual attention, as Mr. Henry stated, that the IFO is facing, is also based upon our faculty, that many of our students' needs are not being met, the individual attention, the one-on-one consultation. We as faculty members have seen cutbacks in professional development to attempt to stay current, working on new curriculum. You heard the other day the central office talking about the 400 programs that could have been developed if the funding was there. We, like the IFO, settled our contract early. We settled for no increase, no steps, for zero and zero. That is correct. No raises across the board for MSCF. We, as an organization, have been in the do more with less mode for 8 years. The thought of things getting worse without some degree of collapse by our organization seems impossible. We've been fortunate because of the federal stimulus dollar in many instances, as well as the burden that's been placed on students by increasing tuition to create revenues over the past few years. Those dollars flow into the college immediately, and they lessen the initial impact today. But it is brought to our attention, and more, we are now more aware of the underlying structural funding problems we have because we know the stimulus dollars will go away. We know that the place and the rate of growth of enrollment can't be sustained. As faculty members, when we stop and consider what the future will look like without that artificial support, scares the living, and you can put the next word in there, as faculty members. We turn to your support to sustain our current level of operations. And maybe from hopeful and wishful thinking that we can gain back what we've lost. You've heard the statistics of the enrollment growth, not only in the system, but tremendous at the two-year college level. We hope that you will keep as your primary focus as you put your bill together will be on teaching and learning, the relationship that takes place between students and faculty. We hope and we will continue to believe that what happens in our classrooms, our labs, libraries, counseling office every day changes lives and positively impacts the state in a positive way. We thank you for your support, Chair Rukavina and members, and remind you that we're doing more with less and have been doing so for the past 8 years.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Any questions of Mr. Nelson? And maybe, you know, I'm sure you'll be giving the members input, you and Mr. Henry, as to where you think some of those cuts can be made or where we can save some money in the system to not have the impact on the students that you're concerned about. So
thank you.
With that, members, the first bill on the agenda is House File 2570, Representative Anzels. Representative Anzels, welcome to the committee, and as soon as we get one more member, I'll have Representative Haas or Obermuller or Clark move your bill for you, but we right now don't have a quorum. So go ahead and present House File 2570. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is a very straightforward, simple piece of legislation that deals with a very complicated part of our great state, and that's the Mesabi Iron Range. Essentially, the bill has two sections and would change the name of a center that has been located in the community of Chisholm for approximately 30 years a center which was the dream of former state senator, former lieutenant governor, and former governor Rudy Perpich. A center which is designed to tell the unique history and culture of the people of the Iron Range. A center which also includes a research center where people can determine their lineage and historical backgrounds. This center is closed, much to my chagrin. This center was once called the Iron Range Interpretative Center. Then it was called Iron World. Then it was called and is called today the Minnesota Discovery Center. I propose a change of name here to the Iron Range Heritage Center and Perpich Archives, because I believe as Iron Rangers, first of all, we should not be embarrassed or retreat from the Iron Range, and we should not be bashful about telling the rest of the state and the rest of the country and the rest of the world about the great accomplishments that the people of the Iron Range have made to this great country. And by honoring the name Perpich, it would be the research center, the library center, the archival center, which would be named after the person who really, really and truly gave birth to this great facility. One more comment about Section 1. Virtually every penny that has been invested in this center has come from the taconite production tax, which is a tax that the mining company pays in lieu of paying property tax. So it is the people of the Iron Range who have built this facility with their property tax money, and I'm asking that you agree to this name change.
The second Van Zelt, we now have a quorum, so Representative Clark moves House Bill 2570 be recommended to pass and just laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Much.
Go ahead, Representative.
I just want to say I'm very proud to move this bill.
There you go.
Thank you.
And Representative Van Zelt, continue.
The second section would change the name of the fund, the property tax fund, which is designed to diversify the range economy and to reinvest in our public works and infrastructure for all of our communities and schools and townships and counties along the iron ore formation, recognizing that once our resource is exploited, the resource is gone forever. And this fund is currently called the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund. The language in my bill would change the title of this fund to the Mesabi Miners Memorial Economic Development Fund as a way of reestablishing, first of all, the credibility of this fund, the knowledge for our people so that they understand what it is this fund is designed for. It honors the miners. My parents, my grandparents, Chair Rukavina's parents, for the labor that was required by them. Because it really is the labor of the miner, besides the wisdom of the legislators at the time, 35 years ago, who created this fund, that we have this fund. I have felt since joining the Minnesota House of Representatives in January of 07, that the people of the range have lost sight of exactly what The purposes of this fund are, and how it is decisions are made to further the diversification in the public infrastructure of the Range community. In fact, I venture to say very, very, very few of our citizens understand that this fund is in lieu of property taxes paid by the mining company and would otherwise be going back to the communities where the mining exploitation is occurring. So this would bring some clarity. It would honor our fathers and mothers and grandparents. And essentially, those are the two sections of the bill, and I ask for your support, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I have been to Iron World. Eddie Rabbit performed there, and I was able to enjoy a nice concert. The question I have is basically in Section 1, I guess. Number one, I'm a firm believer that names should be as short as possible, just so people can remember it and do it, you know, correctly. But my question, I guess, since you said that Iron World or whatever it's called today is closed, what is the plan for the future? And I guess I question why we would even bother changing a name of something that's maybe not going to happen or will be.
Representative Anzell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nornes, thank you for the excellent question. The facility is closed, and I would suggest to the committee that one of the reasons that led to the closure of this great facility is a lack of clarity of purpose, lack of a explainable mission, and differing philosophies and differing approaches as to what the facility is all about. And frankly, Representative Nornes, we've gotten to the point with this facility that it appears to this legislator that we're almost afraid, we're embarrassed to tell the rest of the state and the rest of the world who we are. So absolutely, the name Iron Range has to be in the title. And this is a center where we tell our story, which is our heritage. And this is the archival center for the collection of the manuscripts and the newspapers and the history of the range. And this was the vision of former Governor Perpich. So that's how I came up with the name. And I do sincerely hope that collectively in the months ahead, working with the range delegation and others in the community in northeastern Minnesota, that we will be able to reopen this great facility, that we will be able to laser in on its mission in a more finite way, and that this facility can be reopened. And I think a start is by having a name that people can identify with. I would suggest the Minnesota Discovery Center is a nice name, but it could be for a facility in Bloomington or Granite Falls or Sleepy Eye. But this is a facility on the Iron Range, and we should have the name Iron Range in it.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up or another suggestion. The weekend that I was up there, and it's a few years ago now, I camped up there. I would suggest, as you're looking at developing or reopening and all of these things, that maybe a nice larger campground would be a plus, be a good destination for people, and I think that might be helpful as far as attracting more people.
Representative Mahoney and then Anderson, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anzell. Seeing how I have so many rangers living in my district, I was wondering if you'd include me in any discussion.
Sure.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anzell, when was the Economic Protection Trust Fund named Douglas J. Johnson. How long ago did that take place?
Representative Anderson, I believe it was in the 2002 or 1 legislative session, either in 01 or 02.
And Mr. Chair, was that the creation of it, or was that, no, that the renaming of it?
Members, the Iron Range Environment, it was called the Iron Range Economic Protection Fund. And we referred to it as the 2002 fund because the initial legislation passed in 1978 or 79 anticipated that ore might run out in 25 years, I think. So whatever it came to, maybe it was 77, whatever 25 years was, that's all got to be the 2002 fund. And then in the, and so in all those years it built up a corpus where there were some money taken out initially for a few things, but the corpus is I think about $80 million. I'm not sure what it is, and we're allowed in statute to spend the interest, and we have some money invested long term and some short term, and there are some projects that are also that where some money has been encumbered out of that corpus for some potential projects like I believe Esser Steel's project and a few others.
Okay.
So it was, it was in existence for about 25 years, I guess, when the name got changed.
Okay. So, but it was 2001 when it was last changed.
I think it was 01 or 02. I can't remember which.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Representative Ansel, have you looked at what the cost is? There stationery involved that they're going to have to change, business cards, things of that nature. Are they just going to use their existing supply until that runs out and then change it? How does that work?
Representative.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, these costs would be borne by the agency which administers this fund, which is Iron Range Resources. And again, every penny that comes into that agency, staff, equipment, every penny is property tax money off the production tax, which is in lieu of property taxes paid by the mining companies. So yes, there will be costs, and it will be borne by the agency should this pass and be signed into law.
Well, Representative Anderson and Representative Anseltz, I don't believe there are any actual stationery or signs or anything that specifically refer to this fund. It's just Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Agency. That's been changed. We've dropped one of the R's, which we contest shouldn't happen, but we dropped the rehabilitation. I'm concerned pretty soon it'll be just the IR, which could be a reference to your party. But so there have been, other than those changes, no changes. So any other questions on the bill? If not, Representative Anzels, thank you. Nice job. We'll lay it over for possible inclusion then.
Thank you very much.
Representative Obermueller moves that House file. We're going to take first your 3274. Representative Obermueller moves House file 3274 be recommended to pass and we refer to the full Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Obermueller.
Mr. Chair, there actually is an amendment, so if we could move the amendment.
Representative Obermueller moves the amendment entitled DE1. Is that your amendment?
That's correct.
Okay.
Chair.
Explain the amendment then.
Sure. Mr. Chair, the whole bill is designed here to try to help make sure that Minnesota workers who are in the unfortunate circumstance of having dropped off their current benefit level because they did the right thing, they went out and got a job or a part-time job and they earned enough wage credits to establish a new benefit account. And in some situations, as we heard in the committee, I think last week, maybe it was the week before even, people are going from $400 or $500 in benefits down to $50 or $60 in benefits. And what the bill, the original bill and the amendment is attempting to do is to say, let's figure out how to keep those people up at a reasonable level and get back to these federal extension dollars that are out there. As many of you may know, the President signed that extension bill back into law, I think, two nights ago, kind of in the middle of the night, as they got it finally got it done and passed, because it's kind of critical. to make sure these folks have some money. So the amendment essentially does the same thing we were trying to do before, a different way, and this one is acceptable to the Department of Labor, the U.S. Department of Labor, which is important. And this one, essentially what it does is it says, when you reestablish your second benefit account, we're front-loading, we're accelerating the payments that you would otherwise receive over the course of 26 weeks into a period of time so that your payment level is about 80%, is 80% of what you would have had had you not fallen off the original benefit account that you were in. The long and the short of what it does is it you will go through the same dollar that you would have gone through before. You don't get any additional dollars this way, but you do get them earlier in the process, and then when you exhaust your state benefit account, that new one, you get back onto the federal benefit accounts, which is, you know, critical for these folks who are trying to, you know, maintain their families.
Okay, we have the delete all amendment in front of us then. Any other questions? If not, all those in favor of DE1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Representative Overmeal.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think if it would be okay, I think this is an important issue to make sure that we want to talk about a sunset provision on this, because we don't want we want to do this because of the short-term crisis we're in, but we don't want to have to go, you know, on forever. So perhaps Mr. Nelson could come down just for a second. If he has some wants to comment on the bill, I'm happy to have him do that too. But we've been going back and forth about what a potential sunset amendment would be, and I'm going to suggest that we put a sunset in for just the end of the next year, so December 31st of 2011. Mr. Nelson was indicating maybe a March date would be better. I'm concerned about it being during session. So, but anyway, if you wouldn't mind, introduce yourself. And
Mr. Nelson, welcome to committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm legal counsel to the Unemployment Insurance Program in Minnesota. My only comment about this particular bill, I worked with Representative Overmiller on this, followed his direction. We came up with this language together. Department supports this bill.
And Mr. Nelson, any comments on the sunset date to make it more comfortable for you or the fund or the commissioner or the governor?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I had originally suggested to Representative Overmiller a March 26th date because of what is in another bill which is pending in Representative Atkins' committee. But Representative Overmiller just indicated to me what he would prefer and might suggest the June 30th date. So therefore, the legislature has the whole of June 30th of 2011. That way, the legislature has the whole next legislative session. If conditions change, whether it be to continue it or discontinue it.
Okay, Ms. Newman. Then can we just add on line 1.10? Can you tell us what to do then? And Representative Overmiller can move that amendment.
Mr. Chairman, the amendment would be on the DE1 document on line 1.10 before the period and expires June 30th, 2011.
Okay, everybody understand that? Representative Overmiller moves the oral amendment then. That was just repeated to us by Ms. Newman. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Any questions, members, then? Representative Anderson. Mr. Nelson, you might want to stay there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Overmiller, I just wanted to say I think this is a good idea.
Thank you.
Okay. We got a group hug in our committee. I might have to just adjourn on this one now. Okay. If any other questions, and if not, then Representative Overmiller renews his motion that House file 3274 as amended and as amended a couple of times be re-referred to the full committee on finance. Any questions? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Overmiller, and you might as well just stay there with your House file XXXXX.
Mr. Chair, as much as I'm sure you'd like to have that bill heard, we actually did get it introduced, and it does have a number, and that is 3409.
House File 3409, Representative Obermiller moves House File 3409, be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Obermiller.
And we actually have an amendment. It's, and I'll move the amendment, which is AN-A14. And it's a lot longer than it looks. Mainly, we had to take out Section 4, which was the longest section of the bill, and reinsert it with some different language. I'll be happy to talk through each of those changes, but if we could move that, I move that amendment, please.
So, Representative Obermiller, you're moving then to, let's see here, the A14 amendment is not a delete all, so it's just...
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Obermiller moves the A14 amendment. Discussion on the amendment. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to the point, what the amendment does essentially is move some of the ideas around that were in the original bill. There's kind of a quirk in the way our revisor's office worked. We had stricken some language in the original bill, and so you have to basically take out the whole section and reinsert it when you strike more language in that same section. So there are a couple other changes which I'd be happy to walk through as we go. It probably works best to walk through the whole bill first, which I'm happy to do now or after we adopt the amendment, however you want to do it.
If you prefer to just talk about the whole bill and then talk about the amendment, we'll just wait to move the amendment. Go ahead.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll just kind of buzz through the various sections that are in there and, of course, be happy to take questions as well. Section 1 of the bill directs it – maybe I should step back just one moment and tell you kind of why we did this bill. This is essentially picks up some of the workforce the recommendations of the legislative auditor in the workforce development program. And it also makes some corrections and some clarifications to the work that the UI program is doing, the unemployment insurance program. We've seen, as I mentioned in committee a couple weeks back, we've seen kind of a drift over the last 10 years of, in my opinion, making it the line between whether or not you're eligible for benefits and not eligible for benefits a little less clear. It used to be, and the benefit program, I believe, was designed to be remedial in nature, that if you got fired from your employment, you have to do something pretty wrong in order to actually lose your benefits on top of it. And so as we've tweaked the various definitions in the rule and done different programs to try to carve out for individual groups, we've made that line a little blurry, and this bill is intending to kind of reset the clock and try to figure out where we really should be on this, on the benefit program. So the first section of the bill actually is on a workforce issue. It directs the Governor's Workforce Council to consult with local workforce councils and deed to identify various gaps in workforce services. As you might remember, the auditor's report indicated there were some gaps, and this is directing that workforce council to dig in on that. The second section directs the commissioner to develop a plan to basically analyze and assess the outcomes that our workforce programs are actually getting, and doing that by comparing the people who are actually getting the services and the results they have versus the people who don't take advantage of those systems and the results that they have. Also directs them to figure out how they're going to, you know, make that work within their budget on getting that monitoring covered. And also deals with the pass-through programs, I think, that would be there. Section 3 deals with a workforce auditor report issue, and that's some of our schools, some of our colleges have flexible class programming designed to help workers who are in the transition back from one year to another back into work, and others don't, and this basically directs the board to help them figure out which schools are which and also help encourage the other schools that aren't doing that to help with that flexible scheduling piece. Section 4 of the original bill that's before you is the section that we had to delete and put back in, so I'll direct you to the amendment for that section. This does essentially two things. First, the Section 4 on the amendment is just the definition of staffing service. We're moving that from one location in statute to another. We've added a new Section 5 that is where the meat of this amendment is. And it does two things. It removes something called the 5-day rule, which we'll be happy to discuss in just a second, and it clarifies the definition of employment misconduct. I'll just address the employment misconduct piece first, and that's found on the amendment at line 6.14 to 6, or 7.12, in case you want to go and follow along. But the long and the short of it is that it clarifies that the loss of benefits for an employee is meant to be when their conduct warrants an additional penalty of loss of benefits, not just because they were fired. And the focus on the amendment is essentially to take out things that would make the decision about whether they intended to do something or whether they did something on purpose, and focus instead on what their conduct actually shows. And so the change says that if your conduct is egregious and it's beyond the expectations of what your employer should expect from you, and you know, subject to some exceptions that are listed there in the law, you're not going to be denied your benefits. So it basically it does raise the standard for how much what your conduct has to be in order to be ruled out of benefits, but it does so with a clear, bright line. And the reason that's, I think, critical is because the folks we have doing these adjudications, these claims come into the system and you fill out a big form online and it's sent off to someone who makes an initial decision about your thing. We want to make sure that the line is bright so that they go, this person is entitled, this person is not. Cloudy or close calls make it very difficult for these decisions to be right on the first side, and that clogs up the system up and down the line. So that's kind of the purpose of that chunk. The second section dealing with the five-day rule has generated a lot of excitement in my office recently, so I guess that means it must be an important issue for us to be discussing. The five-day rule, for people who don't live and breathe this law, which I didn't until recently, but we have in current statute, a temporary agency who hires employees, they hire an individual to work, and then they task that person out to a work site that's not their own. So for example, and these no real things, I might hire an employee and send them off to Quick Trip to do accounting work as a temporary employee. That way Quick Trip doesn't have to hire the temporary employee, but they remain my employee if I'm the temp agency, and they work on Quick Trip site. And the five-day rule comes into play when Quick Trip tells that employee, we're done with you, we don't need any accounting help anymore. And under the current law, the employee has been essentially discharged from the person who's kind of controlling their day-to-day work. But that person doesn't really have the job of firing them or hiring them or anything. They're just the client of the staffing service. And under the current law, that employee has the job to call back up to the staffing service and say, I'm done with my work, I need a new job. That's called the five-day rule. They have 5 days to make that request for new work. The actual five-day rule, though, it's really an exception to kind of what would normally happen under these circumstances. If that employee actually worked for Quick Trip, and Quick Trip said, we don't have any more work for you, that would be a discharge, and they'd be entitled to benefits. Here, it's basically a trap for the employee, because if they don't make it back in 5 days to ask for work, they don't realize they're supposed to, they didn't read the statutory form they're supposed to sign at the beginning when they signed it, they missed that window, and then now they're disqualified from benefits. And that's very problematic. The flip side to that is not just some people losing benefits who might otherwise be entitled to them. It's the strain on the system that this law has really put in place. There are, when you fill out your form for unemployment insurance, I'm looking around, I don't think anyone's done that probably recently at the committee table, you have to check a box if you're coming from a temp agency, and that sets into a whole other administrative level on information they have to gather, letters have to be sent back and forth, new information to decide whether or not you made the 5 days, you really requested it, you got the letter signed in advance of, that told you had this 5-day obligation and so forth. And it really becomes this kind of administrative nightmare and costs time and effort of all these folks at UI. It could be better spent actually making decisions, adjudications. And so this law essentially removes that provision. It clarifies things as far as, you know, when someone is coming out of a temporary agency, when they've quit, when they've been discharged, and impacts the ability for them to get their benefits. The original bill then, what was listed as Section 5 in the original bill, is that establishes a benefit review specialist position. And essentially, this will be someone who will be at the UI administration level after these initial adjudications are made, as the information comes in. It's someone you can call up and say, hey, I forgot to send you this information, or I have a question about this. It might help you avoid an appeal, or might help you get benefits if you improperly, unintentionally excluded yourself from benefits because you wrote something down wrong, checked the wrong box, etc. Section 6 of the original bill, which I guess is now 7 or 8 because we've moved some new stuff in there, is a bill that we brought forward last year. It's just an issue we discussed last year. It deals with unemployment law judge pay. This would essentially tie the amount unemployment law judges make to their worker compensation judge, a percentage of the workers' compensation judge. We already do this. Our workers' comp judges are tied to the next level above them, and then those folks are tied to district court judges and so forth, so we kind of rank these down. And it really deals with the level of experience you need in order to do that kind of work. And the goal here is to try to, for new hires that we hire for new unemployment law judges, to kind of create a different level of a pool of applicants that we can be picking from to make sure that we're getting good decisions and proper decisions and good work on that ULJ level. And then the Section 7 under the original bill addresses the workforce auditor's report, the auditor's report from the workforce stuff, and it basically establishes a requirement that there be an actual person in each of these workforce centers to deal with questions that come up about how to apply or how to get into various programs. As many of you know, we deal with this issue now by an automated call center. We heard testimony in committee that you have to have centralized systems to make the system work kind of overall, and I actually thank Mr. Nelson and several others who helped me get a tour of the facility to kind of see how that actually works in practice, and you do need some centralization. But a lot of these problems that come with that have clogged up the system, I think, can be solved if we have a person you could go, which box do I check here on this form? How do I get my appeal file? How do I do this? A warm body to do in that workforce center, and so this puts one in there. Then the last section, which is 8, it's actually back in the amendment again, deals with an administrative penalty if you offer someone work when you really don't have work available. This is it only deals with unemployment. It's a penalty dealing with unemployment insurance issues. But one of the ways, if you were an employer and you wanted to avoid paying paying into the benefit account for your employees, is you might offer them work when they don't actually have work, knowing they're going to refuse the work. You offer them something that they don't want to do, or you know they don't like, or they're not suitable for, and they say, I'm not doing that. And then you can say, they quit. It doesn't happen very often, but we want to make sure we don't as we are in difficult times, we don't want to see people shifting towards that goal. We're going to put in the statute that that's the case. So, sorry, it's kind of a long bill and a very dry subject, I recognize, but happy to talk and take questions. And I know there are some folks who want to testify about it as well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll wait for the testimony if there's folks that want to testify.
Mr. Nelson or anyone? Mr. Nelson first, and then any folks that support it or oppose it. Mr. Nelson, welcome. Again.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the legal counsel to the Unemployment Insurance Program. There are a few comments I would like to make about this bill and some of the concerns, and in some cases some various serious concerns that the department has about the bill. In speaking to the original bill and not the amendment, the first is to Section 4, on page 7, Subdivision 6, the definition of employment misconduct. I have worked with Representative Wilbur Miller on this particular section, and I always indicated that the department doesn't necessarily concur. There's serious concerns about the cost of this bill, and the committee should just be aware of its impact. Currently, people who apply for benefits, 60,000 were discharged. And the question is whether it's misconduct. The department currently About 40,000 of those people are not denied. About 20,000 are found to be misconduct under the current definition. You estimate, and it's an estimate, that this definition will change that for about 20% of those people denied. You're looking at about 4,000 people. And the overall cost, given the current level of benefits, could come to $10,000 a person. This could cost a substantial sum of money. And that is the department's primary concern here, that we're increasing the cost of benefits at a time the trust fund is in deficit. And if you increase benefit costs to the fund, you increase benefit costs to employers ultimately, and that's an annual cost. And the math would come out to somewhere in the area of $40 million. And that's our concern. Again, not necessarily with the policy, but the cost at this time that would put stresses on the trust fund. Just so that members are aware of the impact of that particular provision. Again, whether the policy is a good idea, we work with the representative, and we're willing to continue to work with him to try to bring that cost into a little more manageable realm. The next is concern is on Section 5. Oh,
Mr. Nelson?
Yes.
What were those numbers again that you estimate you've got?
Currently, and this is just at the initial determination process, not an appeal level, about 20,000 of the 60,000 people discharged are found to have been discharged for misconduct currently. This definition substantially raises the bar. And it's just an estimate. It's kind of an estimate. After talking with a number of people, about 20% of those 20,000 will not be denied under this provision, because it substantially raises the threshold of what constitutes employment misconduct. And that's, you know, for this committee, that's a policy matter for the committee to decide. But the cost of doing so is fairly substantial.
Well, Mr. Nelson, if I could stop you there. So I think you told me in my office when we were discussing some of these appeals, which I assume these 20,000 would go, mostly of them would go to an appeal of some sort. And you're just saying they're totally denied.
Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, a person has issued a determination, and they can appeal it or not appeal it. I have to think back how many of those are appealed, and then many of those are reversed. As I said, I didn't get into the appeals. That gets fairly complex. But I think out of that initial 60,000 issues, instead of, you know, 21/3 being denied, it would be less than that. This substantially raises the bar for what constitutes misconduct. I think an estimate is about 4,000 more people will be paid benefits right out of the chute than currently. And again, the question is not the policy for that. The question is the cost of that, and that puts a cost on the trust fund, which is currently in deficit, and costs on employers, which is the concern. Is it just the cost?
Mr. Nelson, you gave a figure of $10,000. Would that be if they were at the maximum level or the average level, or
currently at the maximum of $585 a week for 26 weeks? Currently comes out to just short of $15,000. But the average person who applies for benefits in the last quarter was paid $393 a week. So, and currently over four, it gets fairly complex, but just assuming $10,000 that a person would be paid under this, and just the math of 4,000 people times $10,000 each comes out to about $40 million per year. And what, it may be less than that, it may be higher than that, but that's just an estimate.
And what is the current deficit in the UI fund?
As of last Friday, the loan balance at the Department of Labor, because I looked it up on their website, was $475 million in deficit as of last Friday.
Well, we're hurting regardless. But go ahead. Doesn't seem to be a substantial increase. Representative Mahoney to this point?
Yes, actually to this point. Mr. Nelson, Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelson, your figure of 4,000 people and $40 million, and roughly, and I understand it's an estimate. Is that what would happen today and in 2013 with the numbers from yesterday when the job numbers are back to pre-recession, would that number be approximately the same, or would that dramatically drop when we're back to hopefully 4% unemployment?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, and I hope we have 4% unemployment in 2013, but I've seen the projections and they're not there, unfortunately. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney is correct. I mean, if the number of people applying go down, the cost would go down. If the number of people applying go up, the cost could presumably go up.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, can you just review for me what happens then? You know, we're in deficit right now with the UI Trust Fund. We're going to have to pay it back to the feds, and that's an automatic increase, I believe, in the rate. Can you just kind of go over that again and what that means for the job providers here in Minnesota?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, federal law currently, and it's always under discussion in Washington how states are going to pay this back, but under current law, if the state is in deficit for 2 years, the state will see, employers in the state will see an increase in their federal tax to go to pay it back. So there will be an increase in the tax per worker, increase of $21 a year. So currently the federal tax is $56 a worker per year. The first year after the 2 years you're in deficit will increase to $77 then per worker per year. Then the next year will increase to $98 Then an additional $21 is added each year until you pay back the loan. The estimate in Minnesota is that will be about $400 million over 4 years in additional tax, federal tax, which will go to pay back the loan. And Minnesota, with that payback, will be out of deficit in somewhere estimated about 2015.
Okay. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for Representative Obermueller. The term egregious seems to be an important component of your redefinition of misconduct, and I'm wondering if that's a more commonly accepted term or one that is kind of cleaner in court of law, or why that term?
Representative Obermueller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, thank you for that. The point of it was to make sure that we impart on the ULJs, the unemployment law judges, and the adjudicators that there's a serious change in the current standard. As you know, I respect Mr. Lee. He's done a lot of good work to help me get the language, even though he may not agree with the policy or the cost. But we've actually drifted here. This is what the law was intended to be originally. You had to do something really bad to lose your benefits, and so we're actually restoring it back to where it was. The egregious term is the term, after talking with some ULJs, they'd understand that would, now we understand what you mean, and they didn't understand the tweaks that we've been making over the last few years.
Representative Downey, there have been changes made, and which has made it harder for people to get unemployment insurance that lose a job that, you know, in the past would have gotten it, but there have been little tweaks here that have been, I think, implied to be technical, which have been interpreted to be more than technical by the UL judges. But I do want to understand to Representative Nelson, or to Mr. Nelson, that are you telling me that nobody, the 4,000 people that are the 20,000 people that they don't go to, have the right to go to an appeal? And that, because you've told me in the past that about half of the people that go to an appeal or contest it win. So does your 4,000 number become 2,000? Or they have no right to go to appeal their case?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they have the right to appeal. And that's why I said I left off appeals. It gets much more complicated because an employer may appeal the award of benefits to that 40,000. And it may go to an appeal, and the applicant may be held denied. So, you know, that's why it gets much more complicated. I just throw out general numbers to give you a total. because employers may appeal the award of benefits, applicants appeal the denial of benefits, and you get a certain percentage are reversed. Applicants actually win more appeals than employers. And
but so would it be safe to say then 2,000 of them would have won?
They will almost balance each other out a little bit. You're probably going to have it go down because applicants appeal more often and win more often. The number would probably go up a little bit from that 40. But, you know, that makes it much more difficult. I wanted to keep my explanation a little simpler. But it's more likely to go up if you include appeals than go down if you include appeals. The cost, not by a lot, but few million dollars. I mean, it's, but these again are estimates. I mean, and this is just talking to other individuals. What does it mean for you, given this language? And this is what Representative Overmiller asked me. He said, "I want the bar higher. Let's work on getting this bar higher." And so that's why I work with him. And,
Representative Dattmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the eliminating the 5-day calendar day rule. Is there going to be any limit in which a person has to make applications? Is this what does the department feel about this, Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dettmer, again, our question is not so much the policy. I'll let for this body. We have concerns, and that was one of my 4 points to make about the whole temporary help issue, because it spreads over a lot. I can't refer to any particular section. The question is the cost, again, and affecting one particular industry, an industry which employs over 200,000 people in Minnesota, and the impact that may have. I just saw this bill for the first time, those sections. I've seen some of the others earlier. Yesterday. And the question is, we have not done an analysis of the impact that those particular sections may have, but they will not be inconsequential. They will be fairly significant and for one industry. I can't give you a number right now, but it's going to be tens of millions of dollars.
Representative Downey.
Thank you. If I could just continue to follow up, and thanks. That was helpful clarification. I really don't know the legal differences between a serious violation, between an egregious violation, and displaying clearly some of the substantial lack of concern. But I can just think about the decisions a business might make to avoid putting somebody on the UI rolls and incurring the uptick in their own rates. And so you're going to hang on to, you know, disruptive employees, perhaps past the current threshold that you would, just to make sure that when you discharge them, they're going to meet this higher standard. That's going to have an impact on the workplace. You're not going to hire a person that maybe you should. You might lose somebody else along the way. So I'm just really unclear as to what the legal difference between these terms is, and then maybe what the practical implications of them are. And I appreciate Mr. Nelson's concern about the fund, but I'd be much more interested in having a fair definition here, irrespective of, you know, what it does to the UI fund. I mean, within reason, right? I think a fair definition is most important. I see the chamber lining up. Maybe they can give us some of their opinions on these definitions, or the testifiers would too, but I'd appreciate some more clarity on kind of the definition and what we could ascribe as being the most fair to everybody involved.
Representative Obermiller, do you want to tackle that, or Mr. Nelson, do you want to tackle
it? Well, if you want to go ahead,
Mr. Nelson.
Issue, so.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Downey, to your question, argued cases on the opposite side of Representative Obermiller here in the Court of Appeals, successfully and unsuccessfully. It's successfully on his part, unsuccessfully on his. And that is the question. And I will, as I told him, currently the statute provides serious, uses the word serious, but the court has overlooked the term. I'd be the first one to be blunt. The court just seems to gloss over that term, and I'm surprised why. It was not intended to be glossed over originally. And that is, I understand, Representative Overman's concern. It's just been glossed over, and now how do you get people to recognize it? You change the term. And I came up with the word egregious. After working with a representative, he didn't like my first couple of suggestions. And what you're saying is serious means something bad. Egregious means really bad. I thought using the term really bad wasn't quite a statutorily acceptable language. Egregious. It's got to be bad. It's got to be real bad.
I like real bad.
Real bad. Really bad. It's got to be bad. Not just bad. It's got to be real bad. It's kind of that.
Representative Haas moves to real bad instead of egregious. But so, Mr. Nelson, so I can understand, you came up with this term then, and okay.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative Overmiller, I would make adjustments to him.
For clarification.
Wait a minute, I don't think that helps. I don't, in fact, he said, I want the threshold higher. Come up with, let's work together, and we worked together, came back with it.
And Representative Overmuller, so we understand again, was there in former, previous statutory law a stronger word that has disappeared over time, or just an interpretation by UI judges that made it disappear?
Yeah, I mean, the original
case law or whatever.
Yeah, the real issue has been how these, you know, we've had changes in statute on how we define employment misconduct. We've had court opinions that have adjusted it. Based on the way they interpreted the words that this, you know, this legislature used in the past, and regrettably, for whatever reason, it went from a very clear line to a much closer line. And as we've tried to adjust for, well, that's not what that Court of Appeals opinion didn't make sense. That wasn't what we were intending. So we adjusted, we tweaked it a little bit, and pretty soon we're left with something where basically a rule of violation can be employment misconduct, and that was I don't believe ever the intent of this. And I've done read a lot of cases on this issue. And what this does is that it resets the bar to where it was intended to be, which is if you lose your benefits only when you've done something that warrants the additional penalty of not just being fired, which you can always be fired, but also losing those benefits.
Okay. Testimony then from, no further questions on that. Mr. Nelson, yes, you got one more thing?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
If I might make very quickly on to two other points. Again, I think I already spoke to the issue about temporary help agencies and our concern about the cost and the effect and the impact that would have on a particular industry could be very great. I do have department has some serious concerns about Section 9. Page 9, Section 5, the Benefits Review Specialist. This language has some, I would like to work with Representative Overmiller to work through this language. It has some problems. I won't go into the language itself. The general overall policy, I want to do point out that the statute already provides for a process of amended determinations. And the department issues thousands. I have the exact figures here of amended determinations. So there already is a process in place. It's a little less formal than here. And I think department is more than willing to work with the representative to create a process which could satisfy him without putting the initial burden here. I mean, when we use the term at least 10 unemployment insurance staff persons, we're already assigned the first time I've seen by statute an exact number of people which have to do a function, which could be problematic. And the question is whether you want to create processes at a time the system is being currently barely above water. It is barely holding its own. Minnesota, most states are underwater. They're just so hopelessly behind. Minnesota is above water. We have some serious concerns that this will simply cause us to go underwater. So requiring more process, and again, we have an informal one now, and possibly we can tweak that, work on that, work with the representative. We have concerns about creating a formal process, which you're just adding more to it, and it's going to
Mr. Nelson, yeah. If I recall the meeting we had in our office, and you mentioned a number of you, I can't remember how many go to an appeals process, but you needed, and you told me you needed 11 or 12 more UI judges?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, first of all,
what was the number you told me?
We're currently in the process of hiring 11 additional unemployment law judges, but if I might explain, Mr. Chairman, four left since the beginning of the year. So we're down already. But currently, appeals under stress. But you have to understand the training. I'm going to tell you the training process for unemployment law judges is they do initial adjudication. So, and the intent is to move them back and forth. So
Well, I think, Representative, we should take a serious look at this, and you can discuss it, but, you know, half the cases I go to appeal get awarded to the employee, mm-hmm. is what you told me. And I think Representative Obermiller is looking at this as a way to save money for the system. Instead of hiring 11 or 7 new judges, you hire some people that get paid less that may be experts and know that this case shouldn't be denied because it's just going to go to an appeal and we're going to lose anyway, and I think that was his intent. So if you can work with him to find out a better way, that's fine. But I think, you know, with the judges you want to hire with unemployment insurance funds are just as costly as this, and maybe it helps the process and slows it down and saves the process money. So I hope you'll work with them. But we do have some other folks that want to testify on this, Mr. Nelson, so maybe you'll see some of this stuff again, and we only got 20 minutes left, and I'd like the, you know, folks that don't have time to come to the Capitol all the time to be able to come up and speak. So, Ms. Dolphin, I see you out there with your temp agency issues, I'm sure, if you'd like to come up and introduce yourself for the tape, since you are not a paid lobbyist.
Thank you.
Or paid employee. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and identify yourself.
My name is Dwayne Hendrickson, and I'm with a company called Masterson Personnel. Masterson Personnel is a Minnesota-based company. In 2008, we celebrated our 40th year in business, and we employed 17,000 people. In 2009, we had 4,000 of those individuals drop off. We employed 13,000, and so we're currently operating in survival mode. Not only did we lose 20 to 30% of our business, but we also had our unemployment costs increase 400% over the last 12 months. Today, I'm here representing the staffing industry. We have approximately 900 offices, and as Lee Nelson indicated, we have over 200,000 Minnesotans that we employ each year. The language in this bill would cause tremendous hardship on our industry. We believe that it unfairly targets our industry, and we also believe that it would increase our cost of doing business, which would mean that we would need to increase our rates to clients. Our clients are 3M and Honeywell and some of the, well, 90% of all companies, according to the American Staffing Association, 90% of all companies use staffing services. So we would need to pass along that cost, or we would need to lay off additional workers. With the loss of 4,000 employees, we had to make some tough decisions at Masterson. We closed offices and we let go of people. If you be patient with me, I know we only have a few minutes, but I'd like to tell you just a little bit about the industry. In Minnesota, clients use us for all different reasons. So, for example, Target Corporation hires people from Masterson for their holiday and back-to-school rush. Wells Fargo uses us when rates drop and their call volumes increase. General Mills uses us when food production and manufacturing fluctuates. And so a lot of these things are temporary in nature. Now, when we hire an employee, that employee is told from the very beginning that about the nature of our business, and they're told that their tenure with Masterson Personnel may include working at a variety of companies, and that's on the first page of our handbook, right underneath "Welcome to Masterson." And so, I'd like to bring your attention to a part of the bill right now that deals with it's page 3, line 25.
Are you on the bill?
I'm on the amendment.
Or the amendment?
I believe it's the amendment. Maybe. It took some shuffling and figuring out. But
page 3, line
25, it's subdivision 1, quit. Mm-hmm. An applicant who quit employment is ineligible for all unemployment benefits according to
being. I think it's on the bill then.
The bill.
The bill.
The new version.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, yeah. Okay. An applicant who quit employment is ineligible for all unemployment benefits according to subdivision 10, except when, and then it goes on to list several circumstances, and I'd like to bring your attention to now page 5, line 17, which is the 11th, number 11. So, except when the applicant quit employment at the conclusion of a temporary job assignment with the client of a staffing service employer. Again, we believe that this unfairly targets our industry. So every time an assignment is completed, the employee is said to have quit and becomes eligible for unemployment benefits, even when we have other suitable work to offer them. Even if they understood up front that the job would entail working various assignments at different companies, I'd like to also bring your attention then to page 7, line 25 and 26. An applicant who has completed a temporary assignment with the client of a staffing service employer is deemed to have been discharged by the employer. Okay, so what the bill is saying is that every time one of our employees ends an assignment with one of our client companies, the employee is considered to be discharged from their employment with Masterson and therefore will be eligible for unemployment benefits regardless of why the assignment came to an end. So it could have been that they just partied too much the night before and didn't want to go to work. So the assignment was ended and they become eligible for unemployment insurance. It could have been that their assignment was ended because of misconduct, but they become eligible for unemployment insurance. Again, we believe that this targets our industry unfairly. If we go then to page 5, line 30, I'd like to address the 5-day rule that Representative Obermueller brought up. We oppose the elimination of this language. The 5-day rule simply requires our employees to let us know within 5 days of their assignment ending that they're available for another assignment. Over half of the states in the United States have view the failure of to communicate with the employer at the end of assignment as a firm voluntary quit, including all of our surrounding states, North and South Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Michigan. And so we oppose the elimination of this 5-day rule. Our business is unique in that our employees work off-site and under the direction of our client company. So co-employment exists. We're responsible for their payroll taxes. We're responsible for insurances. They're eligible for benefits. We pay them holiday and vacation. But when they're working on site at 3M or Wells Fargo, they're under the direct supervision of those companies. And it's not uncommon for us to have 200-300 people a day at General Mills, for example, working in their bakery products division. And it's the client refuses to notify us when they decide to end an assignment. It's not even in our control. But to be able to ask one of our employees to notify us when their assignment comes to an end, we believe is not unreasonable at all. And so I guess if this bill were to pass, it would land a devastating blow on an industry that's already in survival mode. There were too many parts of this bill to even mention in the 5 minutes that we've been allotted. And we originally had 3 people set up to speak, but we were told that 15 minutes was cut to 5 and that only one would be able to speak. So,
Senator, already gave you 10 minutes.
I know.
You know.
Thank you, Chairman.
Yes, and I'll even give you a little more if you want. Go ahead. Ms. Dolphin, would you care to add anything?
Yes, I would.
I've never been accused of not being fair.
That's true. That's
I'm not even letting the other side that's for this bill talk. So, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Kathy Dolphin. I am president of Dolphin Staffing, a Minnesota-based company. My mother started in our basement, homegrown, in 1969. I'm also a part of the association that Duane belongs to. And I just want to reiterate a couple of points that Duane made. Most all staffing companies, when you apply, you sign a document. And I'm sorry I didn't bring a copy for the committee. That informs you that you need to contact us at the end of the assignment. This isn't something we hide from people. Second point I want to make is that if our workers aren't working, we don't make any money. So we're not trying to avoid unemployment benefits. We are trying to keep the worker in play and working because that's the only way we earn a living. So just to make that clear. And taking away the five-day rule would just be I don't know how our industry would even survive if every person is automatically eligible when an assignment ends, when that's the exact nature of this business. So I just wanted to clarify those points.
Mr. Hendrickson, you said half the states don't have?
Do have.
And half, so if half don't, do have, half don't, right?
Well, I think it's over half.
Was that over half.
It's over half.
I don't have an exact figure, Mr. Chairman, but okay. It's somewhere around the 30 states.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you have 200 to 300 people working at General Mills a day. Do you have a contract then with General Mills, or do you have a contract with the employee?
We have agreements with the employees, employment agreements, that we have an agreement with General Mills, and that fluctuates. I was giving you an example, but does happen to be one of our clients, and it may be that we have no one working out there one day, and the following week, 200-300 people because of the fluctuation in food production and manufacturing, the demand.
Representative Murphy?
And Mr. Chair, then General Mills doesn't notify you at all that these people are not coming the next day?
I really don't want this to be about General Mills. I was using an example, but I can tell you that our clients in general would not contact us every time an assignment ends. So every time, and I view it as a reasonable thing. If you have an idea of 17,000 people employed, through our firm.
It's not as though they're just working maybe in one area. They could be smattered throughout an entire company, and different hiring managers, some may call and say, I'm done with the person tomorrow. Others may not call. That we don't have any consistency at a client site that they will always notify us that a person is done. And our relationship really is with the employee. I mean, in all other respects, we are the legal employer of the employee. We are the ones that are responsible for the employee. So it doesn't really between the company and them per se. And it's very inconsistent. Sometimes you're told yes, sometimes you're told not told.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
So your client is the person that's providing the job for your employee.
Are you familiar with the nature of temporary staffing companies? Typically,
obviously not, because I'm confused.
Okay, so that's what I was asking. I didn't mean, I'm just, most companies, as Duane said, 90% of all companies in Minnesota will use some kind of temporary staffing to help even out hiring periods. All companies have cycles, go up and down and up and down. And by utilizing a temporary staffing company to fill in the gaps, it allows them to keep consistent employment for the people that they're responsible for. So we fill in the gaps to help them ride that roller coaster, if that gives a better explanation for you.
And so the
go ahead.
The place that you're sending the worker to, that's your client.
Yes.
And the worker
is our employee.
Your employee.
And we have all legal responsibilities for the employee, which don't end, as Representative Obermuller's bill says, So they end the assignment, and therefore they're just automatically qualify for benefits. We're still responsible for that employee for any other issue that may come up under the law.
And so what method do you use for that employee to tell you that they're not going back tomorrow because they were whatever?
That's why when they apply, we have an agreement in the beginning for them to understand some assignments will be a week, some assignments could be 6 months. You have the right to accept or reject any job that we offer you. But should you accept it, upon completion, we need you to notify us so that we may place you on another assignment. Because we have all kinds of ongoing assignments.
Mr. Chair, I got...
Representative Murphy.
I got that, but I don't understand how they notify you.
My client or my employee? By phone call or by email? My employee.
They can come by the office, call
Stop
us,
in.
Email us, just as
long as you... I don't know how you handle your billing if you don't know how long the employer had to...
Well, what could happen for us is that if an employee might end work this Thursday, for example, the time card on that employee may not come in until next Monday. So we may not even know until we see the time card. Then you can have verification that they've ended, but that's a week late, which is why we like the 5-day, because then that gives us the time for them to notify us.
Representative Mahoney, but before Representative Mahoney, Mr. Hendrickson, if you look on the amendment on page 4, I think the amendment that Representative Obermuller offered substantially changes your concerns on the quit reference you made on page 5 of the original bill. You can go ahead and look at that. Well, Representative Mahoney is Representative Mahoney.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got a question and then a kind of a, my own story. So, what is the average hourly wage of a temporary worker that you send out,
Mr. Whoever wants that?
I'll take it. Our workers are paid in competitive rates with what the market will bear. I mean, whatever permanent companies are paying for those positions are most likely what we have to pay in order to compete to recruit those people. So the wages vary if you're talking about a manufacturer or are you talking about a CFO. But in order to recruit, we have to be competitive on pay. So there's not a decrease in pay, if
so
that's what you're referring
to. Ms. Dolphin, if I could, clarification, because that's a very good question. So does a employer, one of your employees going to, let's say, a General Mills make $11 one week, and then you send them somewhere else, and they go to a Target store, and they make $8?
Not usually, because then they will qualify for unemployment benefits. We have to stay within a very narrow margin. We cannot move the pay rate around. Once an employee starts working for us at a given rate, I would probably refer to my technical person here behind me. Cindy, what is the amount the pay rate can be adjusted? Do you know? What rate can a pay rate be adjusted? If a person's been working at $11 an hour and you have to offer suitable, there's a definition of suitable employment.
And Mr.
In order
Chair,
for us to offer suitable employment, I got the question.
Representative Mahoney.
I think I understand, because typically if General Mills, and I don't want to use General Mills,
right.
It's 3M, if it's Tom's Freight and Moving Company, if their permanent employees are making $12 an hour, you are within 5 or 10% of that $12 an hour or even closer. So essentially, those people, if they're going to make a living, they're going to take a substantial lowering of their wages to go on unemployment. So I'm not sure in its entirety how much, how big of a problem this is, and it probably needs a little bit more information and data coming from your part. Because here's what I do for a living. I'm a pipe fitter. I work out of a hiring hall. And I agree. I mean, it is my responsibility. It is not my contractors whom I'm working for's responsibility to call the union hall and say, I laid Tim Mahoney off today because we ran out of work. It is my responsibility to call the hall, say, put my name on the list. I want another job.
Right.
Granted, the contractor, I would say 60 to 70% of the contractors call in and say, you know, we're laying off 10 people or 110 people today. You know, I'm not going to give you all the names, but they're all coming into your hall, just so you know, and, you know, the secretary or the business agent can be ready for a lot of phone calls and office visits and put on that extra pot of coffee. So I kind of get your argument there. There is some responsibility on the employee's part to just call in. I mean, it's not that big of a deal, except I messed up the first time I did it. You know, that's my fault. And I sat on the list for an extra month. But, oh well. But I not taking your argument here that this is causing a serious problem with unemployment, because frankly the person that doesn't call you and doesn't get back out to work is making $200 or $300 or $500 less a week in their unemployment benefits, because if they're making, yeah, I'm not sure the exact dollar figure at the $565 a week unemployment benefits, but I think it's only like $17 or $18 an hour to get to that particular point. So
jump in a little bit.
Are we getting to a question here? Because
no,
we got
go
a
ahead.
Line up.
Go ahead.
Okay, Representative Gunther and then Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mrs. Dolphin, can you tell me what percentage of your clients are there full-time, year-round, year after year, and are they paid very consistently with people that they would the company would hire at full time.
Ms. Dolphin.
Yes, thank you, Chairman, Representative. I'm sure if I understand the question, they're paid consistently, and do our clients use us on an all-year basis? Is
that's
that right. Yes?
That's the question.
Yes, I would say that our clients are all a consistent base with a consistent level of use.
So Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dolphin, this is not, for a lot of people, a job of last resort. It's a job that they seek and arrangements that they want to have.
Yes. In most cases, it provides a lot of flexibility for people to work schedules they like to work, to be able to take time off when they need time off. And maybe we have a lot of people who want to take the summer off or take three months off over the holiday. So our industry provides that flexibility, and they're making that choice when they come to us.
And they don't get unemployment then because of it. They've chosen not to.
As long as they call us, we would prefer they're working. Again, we're not making any income if they're not working. Right. So we are far more interested in having them get on the rolls and get another job than fighting their unemployment. That's not what our industry is about.
But what I'm saying is the flexibility you just mentioned, if that person tells you, I'm going to take a month off during
correct.
Christmas,
they correct.
You're not going to give them unemployment insurance, and they're not.
Well, it's a voluntary termination, so right. No, we're not.
Okay. Representative Downey.
I'll pass on my question, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, has the Chamber had a chance to testify? I'm curious to get their perspective on...
Representative Hawes.
The agent, the person that's hiring from the temp agency, he's not going to be paying the unemployment. The temp agency is going to be paying the unemployment. Is that not correct?
Correct.
Ms. Dolphin, yes.
And so that is why you want to put these people back to work when you have jobs for them to go back to work. And if you have jobs, you don't feel that you should be paying unemployment. They should not be sitting home collecting.
Thank you.
Because you're in the position to put them to work.
Right.
And if you can't put them to work, then maybe they should.
We pay
should.
Unemployment if we
yeah.
can.
But
absolutely.
If they're just going to sit at home and just say, I had a job and now you're going to pay me for the rest of the time, ha, ha, ha. Mm-hmm. That isn't what the temp job is about.
Right.
If you follow the check, so who's writing the check, it starts to make sense, and then you can start to understand it. So maybe off, you know, after the meeting, we can talk about that. Thank you.
Representative Haas, are you writing the check?
You could just give me a job.
Okay, now we'll hear quickly from the chamber, but he's... lobbyist, he's around here
thank
a lot,
you, Mr.
so he'll
Chair.
Be commenting more. Ms. Dolphin,
thank you.
Mr. Hendrickson, thank you very much. I think I gave you 23 minutes.
No one ever said you worked fair.
Oh, it's thank great you. To hear that. Did you hear that? Yes, and Representative Gunther knows that. Welcome to the committee. We'll hurry up with your testimony. I'm sure you want to give your support. It won't take long.
Mr. Chair, I don't know about support, but I think I can do it in a minute. Jeremy Estenson with the Minnesota Chamber. In addition to the costs that Mr. Nelson pointed out, I wanted to hit on something a little bit different. Obviously, we're very concerned about the costs the federal costs associated with getting the UI fund out of debt. And one of the ways that we talk about doing that is meeting with with lots of other stakeholders, labor, nonprofits, these folks, legal aid, and many others. at the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which Mr. Nelson administers. And we talked about maybe a dozen or so different ways that we might be able to deal with a potentially billion-dollar deficit in the UI fund. And unfortunately, none of these concepts were brought up. So as a stakeholder, this is one of the first times we're really getting to vet it a little bit. One of the reasons that Representative Dabney and Senator Bonhoff's UI bill, the one that came out of that advisory council, is not particularly robust is because Congress, as we understand, may take action and create some mitigated repayment terms for states to take advantage of. And one of the things that we heard, and the reason the bill isn't robust, is that if you obligate your fund further or put yourself in a situation that may make it more difficult to get out of borrowing status, you may not qualify for those terms, potential interest forbearance or loss of federal tax credit. So among the things that Mr. Nelson, or in addition to the things that Mr. Nelson covered, that's a major concern for us. And Mr. Chair, I guess I'll cut it short there if there's any questions.
Well, thank you. And members, we're going to not rush this bill through. It's sitting here, but we will vote on the A14 amendment to get the bill in the order that Representative Obermuller wanted. So I think we know all the intricacies of it now, except for the definition of egregious, which is really, really bad.
Really,
and I'm not saying bad. The definition is really, really bad. It's just
that was three.
Okay,
really.
All those, was there just one, really? All those in favor, then, of the A14 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails, and Representative Obermuller, you've brought some very interesting issues up. I appreciate the testimony, everyone. We'll just lay this bill over for possible inclusion. And you all work together for a kumbaya. And Representative, I think Representative Mahoney had an amendment. Can we
bring this back up at a later date for possible inclusion? I can put it on the table.
Okay. Thank you. The minutes, Representative Downey approves the minutes of the March 2nd meeting, if there's any, or moves them. Are there any additions or corrections? Representative Slocum was here, I thought. Was she here last time? No? Okay. Oh. Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Meeting adjourned, members. Have a nice weekend.